2, tape 1. This is side 2, tape 1.
Okay, continue.
We're talking about Tank SY-101.
The emphasis was on ferrocyanide, flammable gas, and explosion factor. There was no monitoring or mention of the terrific list of chemicals that we've come up that will be harmful to us in our breathing zone. The only ones that I recall is ammonia, ferrocyanide, and flam gas.
You say they were monitoring for those?
With Draeger tubes, and I think they had a one type of sniffing machine. But the monitoring and test results were very hit and miss, if I remember, during that time. It was Kerry Martin ended up doing the original sniffing there of that tank exhauster. And that's what they were monitoring, was the tank exhauster. Now, later on with that tank exhaust, they ran across some major problems.
Tell me about that.
I can't recall the time frame, but I can recall some of the people. They had a rubber boot on a portable exhauster that, because they were doing simultaneous transfers as well as trying to pump out, that they plugged up the rubber boot part of it with liquids, radioactive liquids and chemicals. And there was actually one of the bosses that, along with several people, that were splashed with chemicals coming out of the SY stack.
Yeah, I do read, I've been reading, you know, in the documents about a lot of talk about portable exhauster at SY Farm.
Right, that's a P-28.
Okay, 1992. And reading, there's a lot of entries and surveillance reports about untrained people being making decisions where, if you're a trainee, you're not supposed to be making decisions. Unsupervised trainees, lack of following procedures. There are many, many surveillance reports on these kinds of items in the records. Talk about that. Talk about how was it a kind of a slipshod operation, or how was it done?
When the tank burped, that's when the window would open, the window of opportunity. We knew that we had a timeline that we could go ahead and get work done until it built up for another gas burping. So it was actually fairly well measured over a period of time that they could count on it, pretty scheduled, that the tank would burp. Okay, so there was a big crush to get the work done during those time frames. And in doing so, they violated willingly procedures right and left. But it wasn't from the worker level on the most part. It was from the management level pushing to get this stuff done.
Now, I'm writing, so forgive me for a minute here. Talk about how, for the record, for the tape, how big was a window? Was it 6 weeks, eight weeks, something like that?
No, it wasn't that long. I'm thinking that I remember somewhere around 3 weeks or so, but I might be wrong on that. It's been a long time, and there's been a lot of stuff going on.
I'm recalling the tank would burp about every 6 weeks. So a window would be part of that time, and then as you approach the next burp, you would probably back off. Okay.
Yeah.
So, and I hope I'm not putting words in your mouth, but is that...
No, that's the exact words that I'd use.
Okay.
You'd back off because you're getting ready for it to happen again. So, and you didn't do it right directly after the burp. You did it a few days later, and you get your work packages and do your work and stuff. And so, you know, I'm thinking 3 weeks. It might not be that far off.
So true. I mean, that seems to fit as far as what I've, at least what I know of how often the tank burped. And if you say there's a little bit of lag time before and after a burp. So what would be done? What are some of the typical tasks that would be done in that window?
First off, you had to make sure that there was enough risers to put the equipment down that they wanted to monitor the tank with. And they had to remove some stuff, including a thermocouple tree to where I mentioned about the tank dynamics, bending different things that were down there. Apparently, it did that to the thermocouple tree as well, and ended up snapping it off in them trying to remove it by crane. And then, of course, you had to react to that. That was a different situation than what they thought. And they'd have to pull it out hydraulically. And there was a lot of adaptation. And I just think that there was good and bad jobs mixed together. It depended on which crew was there. This is also during the time that during that 3.5 month stand down I talked about earlier, that everybody that was field level personnel identified the ones that were willing to violate procedures and do whatever it took as cowboys. They were identified as cowboys. I still have the write-up from that survey that identifies all the problems. It was run by Virginia Tech, Virginia University, or something like that. And they were with us for 5 days trying to get to the root of the problem. I got a copy of their findings, which I would be happy to volunteer. That would give you a good baseline of what was going on then and if there is much difference about then and now.
Talk about the dynamics within a crew. You mentioned the word cowboy. What within a crew would there be a couple of people that were kind of just didn't follow procedures and the rest did, or would these people tend to group together in a separate work group?
They are still grouped together to this day. And they are the ones that get the bonuses in Christmas time
because
and other things because they are willing to violate. And I am not the only one that thinks that they are extremely selfish people.
Would you say they're dangerous to others?
Yeah. I would not want to work around them on a steady basis.
And what kinds of things, what is a typical example of something you would do to bypass, you know, that or that they would do to bypass a procedure? What, you know, without actually creating a danger of a criticality or some kind of explosion, how close would they get to the line?
Exposure limits.
I see.
Would be a big one. They were a lot of radiological protection folks over the years have been really major ticked off about some of the things that they have done.
They bypassed the HPT's instructions?
Yeah, I've seen that.
As, do they stay in longer? Do they get physically closer? Do they not wear the right things? I mean, what do they do?
Whatever was convenient for them to go ahead and if they didn't feel like doing it, they wouldn't. Even if it was a regulation, they wouldn't.
I like to stick for a while with SY-101 and those years there were Lansing in 91 and 92, and then putting in the mixer pump in 93, and then monitoring how the mixer pump was doing. You know, can you talk about your work scope specifically in those years?
Well, there was work around the clock when the window would open up. Okay, there would be crews on day, swing, and graveyard during the window work. And as far as the different work packages that they would have to get done. It would be, like I say, installing some different equipment or removing old equipment because they needed the riser for something new to put in, and trying to do their monitoring thing. Like the mixer pump was the absolute biggest job that we ever did. And that, I believe, was done with a 36-inch riser.
And I remember the pictures. I mean, that was a big news event. There was a big American flag flying from
right.
the pump as it went in.
Right.
Were people very excited? Did they feel this was a well-done thing? Or did they feel that it had been pushed too hard and that maybe it was a not a safe thing?
Well, we knew it had been pushed too hard, but at the same time, I think that this was kind of a finality, a relief as such. And they've talked about since about removing that mixer pump, but by the very design of it, I think there are so many nooks and crannies that would keep you from decontaminating that with any kind of a water or solution, that it'd be almost prohibitive to take out of the tank, but that's my own take on it.
I know they talked for a long time in 94, 95 about a permanent pump, a second pump that would go in, and this would be the permanent pump, but they never did put that in, did they? So the original
one is
the one that's in there.
Right.
Well, you know, people feel that, okay, now that this is in, the tank will be safer, we won't have to be air lancing it, and things will be better. I mean, did they believe that that would be the case?
I think so.
And was that the case, in fact? Did the workload get less, or was the monitoring of this pump really just as dangerous as the other work had been?
Well, when they intentionally, historically, with any of our tanks, when you intentionally stir them up, you get in trouble. We have proven that with all the different tanks that they've tried to transfer with and stuff. Okay, 101SY was no exception. Now, you would have to figure that 103SY is probably the same type of mixture as what 101SY was. Although I don't know off the top of my head for sure, because we have tried to get listings of specific tanks and specific chemicals in the tanks, and that has been denied by several different means. I know 1HPT, along with one of the bosses, that actually got rained on by chemicals coming out of the SY stack on the old exhauster, that the boss is standing there and asking an HPT, shouldn't I get some sort of survey? Now, I didn't see it firsthand, okay? But I know the HPT that he was asking, because the HPT is the one that also got splashed along with a lot of other people. And they're wondering, radiological survey, that's what we were trained to then. Chemical survey, didn't matter. We had no training on that. Plus, we had no means to do it.
So you're saying that there was a lot of access to rad surveys and the ability to do rad surveys, but chemical surveys kind of fell off the plate?
It more than fell off the plate. It was never put on the plate.
When, if it ever did, when did that change? I mean, you read today a lot about chemical studies ever since the vapor issues of 2004, 2005. Do you think it's changed by now, or is it still at that situation the way it was in the 90s?
It's slowly changing because they realize that the internet is a tremendous source of information to where they can't put things underneath the table like they used to. People can go ahead and educate themselves, like it's what I have done as well. And I recognize the stuff that I've been exposed to, where before, when I had all these bad symptoms for years and years, I didn't know what it was. But when I'm 63 now, when I turn 50, I would not have given you a dime for me to make it to 51. That's how bad I was.
So let me do the math. So maybe about 1993 or so is when you started to feel symptoms. Is that right?
Before that.
During the SY, you know, the time period we've just been talking about, 91, 92. And what did you feel?
I had recurrent infections that I couldn't shake, and mainly sinus-type infections. But I also had stuff that was stumping every doctor that I ran across. And I'm not a hypochondriac. I would try to get better, and, you know, the doctor would give me some medication, and maybe it would temporarily make me feel better. Or maybe it was because of the time of year that you don't have so many bugs in the air to bring you down and make you sick. But either way, I'd go for a while to the doctor, do different testing. He'd give me some pills, and it might be better for a little while, and then I'd come down again. You know, but it was also to where I had unresolved walking pneumonia for almost 2 years.
Was this Hanford Health Foundation doctors or private doctors?
Both.
Okay.
Both.
I'm sorry I interrupted you. You were...
No, that's all right. It got to be some shameful and embarrassing times, too, because when you have a doctor that reaches the end of their expertise and doesn't shut up, and right in the lobby with a room full of people, he throws his hands up in the air and says, "I don't know what you got. What do you got, AIDS?" That's exactly what I was told. And I should have done something about it to that doctor, and I didn't.
That was in...
I was so damn sick that I was looking for relief, and he didn't give it to me.
That was about 93 when you were 50?
Yeah.
And
there was, you know, there was plenty of time before that and plenty of time since.
Were you missing days of work, or was this something that you could continue to work even though you felt pretty badly?
I missed a few days, but I didn't miss as much as maybe I should have taken off, okay? Because I had a devotion to work and devotion to my family.
Did other people, do you know if other people in the tank farms were also, feeling sick, or were they maybe not reporting it, or did they report it?
I think it was all of what you just said. I know a lot of people that are younger than I am that are waiting to die at home.
You attribute this mainly to chemicals rather than radiation, or both?
I have said that for years before I ever found out the truth, is that I think the chemical thing is going to be much worse than anything radiological, because they know about radiation. They've studied it up one side and down the other. And then later down the line, you find out about synergistic effects, and that really leaves things up in air, because they need to study the guinea pigs that they have out here. And they're not doing it. They need to put an epidemiological study on us out here that is better than anything they've ever done in the world, because we've got the most unique situation out here. Even just this week, former Assistant Secretary Grumbly and Mike Lawrence both said in a speech that they gave that Hanford has the most unique set of problems with chemical mixes of any DOE site.
I read that in the newspaper, that our tank waste is more intermixed, has more components in it than it, that makes it more complicated and mysterious than the tanks at the other sites, because ours are older and they have more chemicals from different early processes mixed with newer chemicals. Is that what you meant that you heard from them.
Right.
Yeah.
And I would like to pose the question that if they could go to the grocery store or hardware and pick out 100 of the very most friendly chemicals they could think of, empty the contents out in a room, and mix it all up together, if they'd want to be in that room or not. Because I can guarantee you the answer would be no.
At the time, this is 93, you're beginning to, or you are sick, and you're going to doctors. What's going on at work? I mean, is it business as usual? I read from, say, about 1994, some of the things I looked at was replacing ventilation fans in SY fund, procuring a backup portable exhauster for SY101, installing thermocouple trees in the organic tanks, and doing a lot of tank samples. That's what I read that was kind of going on in 94. Were you involved in those activities?
All of that stuff, we wouldn't know from one day to the next. It was just part of our work.
And at that time, I know in 1994, they celebrated 5 years of the Tri-Party Agreement and had quite a celebration and said that there was a lot of progress. But then the congressional elections of 94 went totally Republican. It was the so-called contract with America. And there were budget cuts that came as a result, big budget cuts for the site. I remember early in 95, as soon as the year started, the budget cuts came, big layoffs. How did that affect the work where you were?
There was still a lot of work going on, but if they were doing budget cuts, that also meant personnel cuts.
So do you feel that you know there was simply less work that was funded, or was it, were you still expected to do a lot of work, but maybe quicker, or something of that nature?
We were definitely expected to do things better, cheaper, faster is what they said. That was their key little words, but bottom line, quicker,
so,
more work, tighter schedule.
Did you continue to feel sick during 1994?
I've been sick ever since the late 80s. Definitely the late 80s.
Were people at work, including your coworkers and your supervisors, aware that you were feeling sick and that?
Right.
And did you at the time tie it to the tanks, or had you not?
I suspected it. Everything lined up that, you know, I was. It had to be more than just a bug that was going around. That, you know, I suspected it, but I had no way of proving it.
Did you talk about that ever at work, or were you afraid to talk about that at work?
No, it was getting more to where things were a little more open, and among your coworkers and stuff. You know, I was actually feeling some relief that, well, someone else feels sick, and so maybe I've got what bug they've got. And it was actually where I'd be checking and think that, you know, it might be a source of relief that it's just a bug that's going around. Or really it wasn't. Or maybe it was on top of a bug.
I'm reading from 1995, and it seems that the work that was going on was pretty similar to 94. Trying to close the unresolved safety questions on flammable gas and SY farm, trying to, but not quite getting it done.
Right.
In 95. Thermocouple installations still in the organic and ferrocyanide tanks. Still trying to design and construct a backup portable exhauster for SY101. While they're doing this, are they still using the old exhauster with the rubber boot that had been contaminated?
Periodically they would, and if they had to shut down the main exhauster with some sort of maintenance or PMs, then they would use the P-28 as a backup. But what regularity, I really couldn't remember to tell you.
What was, and your work scope during 95 was pretty much the same. You were pretty much in the S farms most of the time.
Any farms, but S Farm, SY Farm was the number one priority.
And just going in and doing all kinds of maintenance and sampling and equipment in and out, things like that.
Right, right.
Were there any incidents that were, you know, more, that stand out more than others? Or was it, you know, kind of routine?
I just say it was routine. We trusted safety more than we should have.
And you're wearing masks, but not with chemical canisters in them?
If mask was required, but even now, today, they say that there's no requirement in SY for mask.
Is it the worker's choice, or is it the worker's choice to wear or not wear a mask?
Yes, but there's also been discussion by management that if somebody wants to wear SCBA and other people don't, that maybe we need to match the people up with the job to where they're all wearing the same level of protection, which makes no sense except politics is taking precedent over science right now.
Why is that? Is it the feeling that somebody could come out and take a photograph and there'd be a mixed crew and that wouldn't look good? Or why does the management want everybody to dress the same on a job?
So they could stay time. It has to do with stay time.
I see. Okay. That's
right. Because they don't want somebody to jump out and say, well, we got to quit now because I got to go change a 1 hour air bottle.
I see.
And so, they're trying to equalize the stay time and get the job done, which to a certain extent you can understand production, but at the other extent would be that the science is being shoved off to the side.
Do you think that there is pressure to not wear a mask?
Yes.
And is it subtle or not subtle?
I think it could easily be both, depending on who you're working with, what the job is, where the farm location is. Like this time of year, the air is very heavy, very moist. C Farm, although it's not on mask, I would absolutely believe in wearing an SCBA in C Farm. And the other farm would be SX because of radon buildup and chemical buildup in the air as well, I believe, although they haven't given any monitoring results on those farms yet. They're in the process.
It says in your work history that you also, in the mid-90s, began to spend some time at the A farms over in the East area. And what brought you over there?
The work scope might have been to the point that they didn't have enough personnel, so they would borrow from our personnel. In other words, bring a whole crew over there to do a particular job.
I remember a lot of upgrades in the A farm areas in the 90s, new ventilation systems at AY and AZ, and a lot of the work on the interties, the piping between the tanks, and the instrumentation of the interties. Did you get involved in any of that, or were you mostly still doing sampling?
Not really. No, the upgrades in the East area were most of the time, I think, handled by East personnel, but they I'm trying to remember during the time frame, but that might have been on some overtimes or maybe on the weekends as well. I just can't remember the time frame right now.
Did you want a break or anything? I mean, how are you doing?
Break wouldn't be too bad.
Okay. We're back from a break, and it's this is still side two, tape one, Michelle and Dale. We're going to go back and talk a little bit about the earlier periods that we kind of covered this morning, but we're going to go back and cover some more of those same years. And I see on your chart that there were you were present at a pit fire in AX Tank Farm in the late 80s or 1990. Can you start and talk about that?
Right. That job was with the crane crew. Chuck Peoples was the manager in charge. And we had to get into a pit that had an unusual configuration. If I recall, it was about 4 feet by 4 feet and 12, maybe 15 feet deep. Well, during that period of time, we had as a contamination fixative that was used all over the Hanford site. It was called Turco Fabrifilm. Okay, that Fabrifilm was highly flammable. We also had to go ahead and wash out the wand that we used to apply that with methanol alcohol, which is also highly flammable. Okay, so they quit using that in 1990, and the date directly corresponds to a pit fire that we had. After that, they quit using it. This pit fire, it involved us taking the pit cover off, doing our rad surveys, well, the radiation monitoring did, and we as operators had to use contamination control, so we sprayed this liquid plastic on, which is called Fabrifilm. We sprayed it on to fix any contamination that might be loose and fluffy. Okay, so after we got through spraying that pit down, we cleaned the wand out so we wouldn't have it all plug up with goo as the stuff is hardening. And so we used the methanol alcohol. And after we were through with that, then we started doing the pit work itself. Okay, so my job was done for the moment. I had walked a few feet away from the edge of the pit, allowing crane and rigging to go ahead and hook up their wrenches, their impact wrenches, and go ahead and connect or disconnect jumpers and what they were doing. And so I was getting a rad survey. I had my back turned to the pit, and these guys I knew were using the impact wrench. Well, in doing so, the impact wrench had a slight arc to it when it didn't have much resistance. But when you start getting more resistance, that arc jumps even more. And as it did, this methanol was layered in the pit, unknown to us. And the arc made it catch fire. That fire leapt up 12, 15 feet above the top of the pit. And it was so intensely hot that it melted a very thick electric cord to the impact wrench instantly. And then that ignited the Fabrifilm. The Fabrifilm burnt probably just as hot. We couldn't tell the difference. It was just very hot. And so we made the notifications to the fire department right away. Oh, I want to backtrack on this. The boss that was in charge of that job, although he was not found at any fault, none of us actually were, I said that I was being radiologically surveyed and I had my back to the pit. Well, he was in such a panic that he ran right over the top of me, knocked me down. Although he didn't hurt me, I'm still wondering what's going on, and then I see what the whole picture is. Well, us being dressed in masks and SWPs, we tried seeing what we could do to stop the fire. The fire department was on its way. We didn't want to use a pressurized fire extinguisher because it might fluff contamination out of the pit. We were thinking radiological the whole time. Where the reality is that I ended up just getting a shovel and getting some dirt right next to the pit and fluffing the dirt, did that two or three times, and it actually put the fire out. We thought, being dressed with that PPE at the time, that that was sufficient because that's the way we were trained. Turns out that that could have been a major exposure of chemicals. And if you take a look at the central nervous system damage that Fabrifilm can do, and I have a copy of the MSDS on that as well, it is extremely bad to the central nervous system. I ended up not knowing anything about that for several years. And I don't know if that ties in with my exposures or not to chemical hazards. There was no way to measure, so there's no way to show any damage.
So after this fire incident, you were never tested for chemicals or...
No.
And you were not wearing any canisters that would have protected you from chemicals, is that right?
No, that was the P100 particulate radiological cartridge with no chemical property protection.
And later, when you saw the MSDS on Fabrifilm, what did it say it had in it? You know, what are the biggest constituents?
The biggest problem is toluene.
Oh, dear.
And I already have given the council a copy of the MSDS on that. It was no longer used after that pit fire, so it was definitely a dividing line there.
I have heard from others over the years that Turco, which was a California company that had an office in, big office in Spokane, supplied a lot of chemicals to Hanford. Were you familiar with other chemicals here that were Turco trademarks?
Out of the laundry, I know they used Turco. I know that Fabrifilm was used all over the Hanford site in large quantities as a main contamination fixative. We even sprayed it on railroad cars that came in contaminated at various times. But we sprayed large areas of the ground that had contamination. There are other people that are witnesses to this. I can give names and phone numbers.
How about the other people that were there at the fire that day? Do you still work with any of them? Have they experienced symptoms?
The boss is... I see him every day. I still work with him. He is built like a moose, but has diabetes for several years now.
Talk more about some of the chemicals that you've identified. I know toluene is kind of spoken about a lot today when we get our HAZ worker training. That's one of the chemicals that's often used as an example in training. What are some of the other, you know, big hitters that were used around the site that you now identify but maybe you didn't know about at the time you were using them?
Well, it's not so much using them as it is that they are either in the tanks or on top of the tanks where the tanks leaked and there were major spills from the leakage. Well, these vapors are still being given off, I would imagine, because if you don't get rid of the source of it, but rather cover it up with plastic or rubber mat or lead sheet and gravel, then it would still be a source of vapors. And the unplanned release sites that they have, UPR, they're all over between East and West Tank Farms and other sites in Hanford. And as far as I know, I don't think there is any monitoring of these UPR sites. Or maybe they're starting to learn that they should monitor. Some of them cover several acres.
And tell me about the kind of whole subject of drips around the site. First of all, in the tank farms, tell me, how does a tank leak? at the surface? I mean, how does it leak onto the surface? What are some of the mechanisms that cause that?
Broken transfer line, piping, failed equipment, misrouting at times.
Is that just, I know you can't give a percentage, but what about in general? Is that very prevalent, slightly a drop here and there, or, you know, how does that sort of play out in most of the farms?
Just over the years, and I could give you a, for instance, we used to do overground transfers from tank to tank because the piping itself would have either questionable integrity, or maybe the piping for transfers had failed, or in S Farm especially, that was a major problem that they found. They couldn't use any of the transfer piping because it had failed. It had leaked. And so they cut out so much of the overground transfers there because of that. Now, Westinghouse got back to that after ridiculing overground transfers. They ridiculed it for quite a while, and then they found out that that's the only way that we can get stuff done. So right now we have overground transfer lines.
With
In various farms.
Now, I know S Farm is a single shell farm. Was this mainly a problem in the single shells or also in the double shell farm?
As far as I know, it was almost, if not completely, with the single shell.
And now we know today that all the so-called interstitial liquids have been pumped out of the single shells. But you're saying that there's still, or are you saying that there are still spots where this contamination did happen in the past and hasn't been removed?
In the past, yes, and it has not been removed.
Is this all in farm or is this between farms or outside?
Outside as well. It is all of the above.
And was this from transfers between farms, or was this some other way that it got out there?
As far as I know, it was transfers within the farm and maybe contamination releases, possibly due to weather. I can give you a, for instance, there at BX Farm, years ago, we had a Chinook wind that melted 11 inches of snow, and the berms that they have in that farm might do a nice job of shielding the piping, but they can also make nice little dams. And all of this snow melt that we had from 11 inches accumulated in the dry wells and LOWs, and also behind the berms, making little dams, and we had to pump all that out. Now, when we did, we got a submersible pump, found the lowest spot in the farm, and pumped it across the road and into a zone on the other side of the road, because we couldn't leave all that water, contaminated water by then, in the farms to absorb down through that area. We had to try to get rid of it so we could get back to functioning normally again and be able to do the everyday work.
When you pumped it, you pumped it outside across the road, did it just go to ground disposal?
Yes.
On the ground?
Yes. And that is a rad zone now.
Do you think that all the areas have been identified, or are there still some areas on the site that these things have happened and they're just undocumented?
I know they haven't been all found on the site. And I tell you exactly why. Several years ago, when I worked at burial grounds, I was spotting for a clamshell drag line crane, the huge cranes that they use for dragging out the dirt and making a drive-in trench. Okay, all of a sudden, we hear this clunk, scrape, screech, and I'm telling the crane operator, "Whoa, time out." It turns out that they found a full-size burial box, concrete burial box, that was reading like 100 MR at 100 feet away. And it was one of these midnight burials that nobody had any paperwork for. They let it set for, if I recall, a few weeks. And finally did whatever they had to do with it. And they covered it back up. And no one has been back in that area since.
Where is that area?
It's in West. It's between Tea Farm. It's not far away from the north side. North, no, that would be the west side of Tea Farm.
Mm-hmm.
And it's between there and the burial grounds. And if that top to that burial container would have popped or ruptured somehow, we probably wouldn't be in West area at all.
My gosh.
Nobody.
It was that hot.
It was that hot.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Now, when something like that happened, did they then document it after they bumped into it?
I don't know what they did to cover the bases because we weren't involved with that end.
Right. I was going to go back to the tank farms and especially the single shells where, you know, the underground transfer lines had failed, so they weren't using them, and they would rig up over ground. Were these rubber hoses, steel reinforced rubber? What were they using?
Pipe in pipe is what they came up with. I can't recall the materials used, but I believe that they also had like a rubber hose inside a metal pipe.
So you would have to hook these up. Is that part of the work that you did? Hook them up to each of the tanks that was going to be part of the transfer?
I didn't get into that part because that was kind of the later night. Mm-hmm. Later 1990s.
Right.
And after the SY window work, I spent less time at the farms because I had switched over to supply and also taking care of all the emergency response equipment for West area.
Talk about the time that you went up to the underground area in May and June of 82 and were doing some of the outage work. What were you simply loaned up there?
Right.
And how long were you up there? Just a couple months?
Not even that long.
And what did they actually have you doing? And also talk about the training you got.
Timekeeping, which we were already trained for. And to a degree, contamination control, but most of it was working in conjunction with the HPTs that were up there, so it was just operators and crafts that were actually doing the work.
And you were essentially functioning as an HPT while up there?
No, as an operator, as an operator.
Okay, and what was going on? Was this right in the reactor? Was this packaging things out of the reactor?
It was the back side of the reactor, and one time the fitters were grinding on welds, and it was a set dose that they were getting, and then every hour they would switch out. And that way everybody should have the same exposure dose, although that wasn't the case. There was something come up that I caught as what I thought was the problem, and it turns out that's exactly what the problem was.
What was it?
Some guy, a pipe fitter, that is exceptionally short, and I can relate to that being 5'7". All the other pipe fitters were standing up, grinding on these welds and stuff like that. And everything was going fine. And then all of a sudden, this guy, his pencil reads that he's burnt out. And what it was in order for him to do the same job, being shorter, he had to about lay on that weld to get it done. So the quality of work was there, but the exposure was much higher because of his height. That's exactly what shook out after they checked his pencil and all this other stuff. That's what they came up with.
And this, did this involve grinding on metal, you said?
Yes.
And so when that is happening, are chemicals, are lubricants used? Is there solvents being poured on this as it's happening?
I didn't see any of that, no. I was pretty much on a dry weld.
Okay. So this is metal dust then, not necessarily chemical up there?
I didn't know one way or the other.
Okay.
Our main concern was the radiological exposure,
right,
which is what we were trained to.
You also mentioned being a waste truck, well, having waste truck training. Did you ever work on the, was this liquid waste and solid waste? To what extent were you working with that?
Right. Well, we would pick up the solid waste from Purex, and that could be rags or absorbents that would have liquids, for which we wouldn't know what the liquids were. Once again, we paid attention to the radiological, and the chemical training wasn't there at all. That we picked up a lot of waste off the Purex back dock.
Was this waste in drums and bags and what?
Mainly in cardboard boxes. And that went on for years and years before they finally decided that they needed better packaging.
Was this known to be rad waste in cardboard boxes?
Right. It was classified as low-level rad waste.
When you were sent to do a job like that, did anybody give you like a facility orientation for Purex? Say this is what they do.
Originally with Purex, yeah, but it was mainly to familiarize with where you were going, and no further, not really any further. It wasn't really required.
And hazardous worker training, which we received today, you know, which has to do with chemicals, you were not receiving that.
Nothing.
When is the first time you ever did receive chemical worker or haz worker training?
About a little over 2 years ago. And a lot of the things that I identified as being exposures, I was put down for asking those questions.
In training,
right.
Who was doing that? Was the instructor, or was your supervisor there in the same class, or what?
That was the instructor.
And is this when it started to dawn on you, or that you began to suspect that chemicals could be the really real problem here, was as
absolutely
as recently as 2004?
Absolutely, yep.
And these classes were kind of the spark for that realization?
That along with some kind of veiled admissions, I guess you might say, that there could be problems out there for people.
Was this difficult in your case? Do you know if other workers were at all questioning the chemical aspects or talking about them or reading about them or anything?
I don't think that there was any effort by hardly anybody, if anybody at all, to look that direction. And I had looked some of the other directions for why I was feeling the way I felt, and I was getting no answers from any doctor. That's when I started to pay more attention to some of the other things that could be going on.
Could you talk about, in 1983, it says you received salt well systems orientation, and I assume that means the salt well pumping in the single shell tank.
Right, and the reason I got that was because we, like I said, I was in on the first salt well jet pump installations and repairs, and they did not work well. We were repairing them all the time.
What was the problem? I mean, tell me about, you know.
New technology trying to make it better, and I could understand that. We were all trying to make it work right.
And this is a case where you take a big, almost sleeve and you put it down into the tank riser and allow, and the sleeve almost acts as a sieve, keeps the solids out, lets the liquids drain to the center. Is that correct?
Yes.
And then you pump that center. What was the problem? Was it the pump? Was it the well?
We had pluggage quite often. That was before they came up with a good salt well screen. And that when they did come up with the screen, then it quit being so much of a problem. But we didn't have a good screen to start with.
Okay. And then I remember seeing some of the screens on the ground, you know, before they had gone into tank in about 98. And
those would have been the best ones.
Okay. They looked like big, I don't know, cylindrical kitchen strains, really.
Uh-huh.
Giant, though. So the size of the hole, I imagine, is a factor, and the material it's made of, and all of that,
right.
And how it's placed in the
force of the pump, size of lines, that all had to do if the thing would plug readily or not.
If the screen was plugged, did you have to then pull it out?
No, most of the time they could go ahead and reverse water flow and flush it.
So,
although I wasn't involved with a lot of that, I was involved with the installation and maintenance of it, but the actual function, I was rarely involved with the function.
And all of this was still in the 80s, is that correct, the salt well work?
Yes.
And did you wear just a regular rad suit again without?
Right.
Okay. And did you feel protected by that at the time?
Industrial health and safety said it was all right. They were professionals. We trusted them, and we should not have trusted them, because that's why we're in the mess that we are today.
Now, are you saying these were IH techs? Industrial health.
It was before IH as such. It was just called health and safety.
Okay, so when is the first time you remember a person, a worker, identifying themselves as an industrial health technician or having an organization like that?
Maybe the late 1990s. But I don't know if it might have been sooner, but I just don't seem to think that there was much of anything until the late 1990s.
Talk about, for a minute, the older workers that you worked with, say, in the 80s. Were there a lot of older workers, and were they healthy? Did they seem sick? Did they complain?
There was a mix of older and younger workers. An awful lot of them have health problems now, and that's also been well documented, but they have just realized the last 3 years or so just that there might be a connection, and because of that there's a lot more health and safety questions that are being asked, even by the construction forces out there now. So we're hoping that people will wise up and wear the right PPE for the scientific reason rather than not wear it for the political reason.
I was going to ask about, it mentions here on your work history, improperly buried lead installed on pits, risers, caissons, and tank farms, and this is in the mid-80s. Can you talk about where this lead was and how you worked with it?
Well, I've identified problems with the lead program overall, and some of those problems are still ongoing. I even wrote a PER on it, for which there was two additional PERs written by management recognizing that yes, there is a problem. And one of the problems is that their lead accountability is non-existent for several years. Now there were records of it, but nobody knew where they were at. Well, I found where they were at, and I've got copies of those records, and I've got pictures of those areas that are in bad shape, like just in one or two farms. But it's in all the farms.
Talk about where the lead was, and what form it was in, and what you mean by bad shape.
Okay, there's actually two parts to this. The one deal is about the lead program and the accountability not being there. What type, how much, where the location is. There, in the process of fixing a lot of that now, although there's a lot of it they haven't fixed, there's still raw lead out there. And I firmly believe that they are violating